The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Avery Lewis from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence and Ebony magazines. The first article is called The Rise of the Entrepreneur. The Rise of the Intrapreneur from Essence magazine. These innovative corporate go-getters prove you don't have to quit your day job to forge a new path. Since 2007, the number of companies owned by black women has nearly tripled. We're killing it as boss ladies, but let's face it, entrepreneurs isn't for everyone. For some of us, giving up a steady paycheck may not be feasible or, frankly, all that desirable, but you can still find a way to channel an entrepreneurial spirit while you're on the job. It's called intrapreneurship, and companies are taking notice and rewarding innovators with promotions and other incentives. There's a shift occurring. Organizations are paying more attention to ideas that are brought forward by their employees, whether they have innovation in their titles or not, says Simone, author of Disrupt It Yourself, HarperCollins Leadership, and CEO of Blood Orange, a Minneapolis-based consulting firm. Supporting innovation and entrepreneurship. Get inspired by these women who launch big initiatives while keeping their day job and raising their profile in the eyes of the corporate influencers. Laurice McMillan, 24, Associate Social Media Editor, Refineries 29, Unbothered. When Laurice McMillan was working as the social media community manager for the news and lifestyle site Refinery 29, a colleague, Allie Hickson, approached her with an idea. Hickson wanted to make it easier for black women to find the site's content that was specific to them. McMillan knew at once that the concept would be a hit, and she quickly volunteered to help bring it to fruition. They worked tirelessly to build what would become Unbothered, a channel of Refinery 29 for black millennial women that launched in November 2017 and now has 49,000 followers on Instagram. Give yourself time. McMillan says it took about 9 months to get the idea ready to pitch to senior leadership. From studying data and consumer insights to designing the look and feel of the content, the team had to bring their vision fully to life before they could present it. Know your worth. McMillan quickly saw the value added to the team and ran with it. I knew what black women were saying and the types of articles they wanted to be able to find more easily. Work smarter. While helping to launch Unbothered, McMillan still had to fulfill her responsibilities on the social team. The dual roles required her to master a new level of time management. The silver lining was that she was able to shine by handling her own calendar more efficiently, in addition to meeting her manager's expectations. Rovina Broomfield, 32, Senior Product Manager, Kimberly Hill, 29, Marketing Manager, Amazon's Textures and Hues. We've all probably had conversations with our girlfriends about the struggle to find the best products for our particular hair texture, what works, what doesn't, what to buy, and where to buy it. When this challenge came up during a Black Employee Network meeting at Amazon's headquarters in Seattle, two women in the room knew they had the expertise to solve it. Kimberly Hill, an account manager helping entrepreneurs sell on Amazon, started meeting with Rovina Broomfield, a senior product manager on Amazon Echo, after work to put together a formal pitch. They made compelling case for creating an Amazon storefront dedicated to the hair care needs of black women, Amazon agreed, and the site Textures and Hues launched in February 2018. Broomfield and Hill even received a commendation from the company's founder, Jeff Bezos, for their initiative. Lean on official channels. While not every company will have a way for employees to pitch ideas, Amazon does. It's called the six-pager. Any staff member can submit a six-page memo for review. The best part of that process is you don't have to fight to get your foot in the door to give presentations or present demo reels, says Broomfield. Having direct access to the decision makers helps aspiring entrepreneurs cut through the noise, allowing the best ideas to be heard and implemented. Visualize the end result. One requirement of the six-pager is the inclusion of a press release draft. If the project launches, what would its promotional material say? This required Broomfield and Hill to set up clear targets relating to the metrics they wanted to hit, the customers they wanted to reach, and the market impact they believed they could have. Don't feel pigeonholed. Neither Rovina nor I worked in our current roles when we first got started, but that didn't stop us from seeing a way to innovate, says Hill. Don't be afraid to step out of your lane and see if a customer experience you go through every day is flawed. But don't stop there. Hill and Broomfield took the critical next step by coming up with a plan to improve the less perfect customer experience. Maya Banks, 33, Director, Brand and Editorial. Jasmine Lawson, 27, Manager, Brand and Editorial. Netflix's strong black lead. When Netflix unveiled its Great Day in Hollywood shoot in June 2018 at the BET Awards, it was paying homage to the iconic Great Day in Harlem photo of a previous era's jazz greats. The Netflix shot was the brainchild of a strong black lead team whose platform had launched just months before under the leadership of Maya Banks and Lexi Nasita, and now includes Jasmine Lawson and Miles Worthington, who oversee the platform daily. The goal of the strong black lead, says Banks, is to more fully engage black audiences with Netflix, whatever black people, women in particular, are watching or discussing. Strong black lead is creating a space for them to have the conversation. Start small. We started with a single campaign in 2017 called The First Time I Saw Me, which opened up the conversation with talent and influencers about the first time they saw themselves reflected in entertainment, specifically in television and film, says Banks. Ava DuVernay and Spike Lee took part. The campaign was a hit. It went viral and became much bigger than us. She continues, we realized there was an opportunity to really build community around women of color specifically and to talk more about their experiences of the stories that we're telling on Netflix. The success of the campaign made Banks' strong black lead pitch easier. We already had proof the concept works, she explains. Let the numbers speak. With the First Time I Saw Me campaign under their belts, Banks was able to lobby effectively for more funds and the creation of an official platform and team. I was able to say, look, we spent X, Y, and Z on the first time I saw me, and the return was so much greater. If we were to do five of these over the next year and invested in an ecosystem across social channels, here's what it will cost and what we're expecting in terms of the return of investment over the next 12 months. People have a lot of good ideas, but a company also needs to see how it's going to benefit them, says Banks. Build a cheering squad. When banks brought on Lawson 3 weeks into the launch, they still had to drum up more support internally. One of the VPs on our team always says, if you have a big idea, you're working on it by yourself. It's probably not a big idea, says Lawson. The duo, along with key members of the editorial team, decided to socialize strong black lead to groups within the company, putting together a cross-functional team to get people excited across multiple departments. Don't be afraid to fail. Entrepreneurs are producing something that hasn't existed before, so a few missteps should be expected. I've been set up for success in other roles because it's been more cookie cutter. You do this, you do that, you get this outcome, says Lawson. This is the first time there hasn't been a roadmap. You have to be willing to try and fail and try again to figure out what's working and how to make it even better. Your time to shine. Sitting on an idea you think your company should pursue? Here are three things to consider before getting started. Know the risk. If you decide to take a detour and spend time on an entrepreneurial endeavor, there can be, in some organizations, a risk to your career trajectory. You'll need to get real with yourself about how your company, about how your new ideas impact your current job and your future within the company. Keep it frugal. Asking for a big budget to fund your project at the outset may be tough to sell. Even if you're a well-resourced organization, as soon as there's a budget attached, you'll have more scrutiny. You have more business as usual processes. What I often recommend is that people do a little bit of experimentation so they can create and test their hypotheses. Don't ask for permission. By starting small, you can own the idea before taking it to the top boss. This can also help protect you from having your idea stolen by higher-ups. If you're more junior within the company, we have to give ourselves permission not only to have an idea, but to start executing it in a bold way. Get comfortable breaking the rules. Your path isn't clearly defined as an entrepreneur, so you have to be able to manage ambiguity and a little messiness. Leader of the Pact. After spending 3 years at the helm of the WNBA, Lisa Borders is now heading Time's Up and ensuring that the organization stays in the game. Less than a year after women in Hollywood began taking a stand against sexual harassment by declaring Time's Up, Lisa Borders, 61, left her role as president of the WNBA and became the very first CEO of the Time's Up organization. Her transition became official in November 2018 when the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh hearings were at the forefront of everyone's mind. You might say Borders stepped into her new position at an opportune moment. She was just in time to shine a light on yet another government official accused of predatory sexual behavior. Borders' own career has taken her from a job in politics to the WNBA. Now, as she assumes her latest role, she opens up about her life and her plans for the organization. Essence, was leaving the WNBA a hard decision for you? Lisa Borders. It was not a hard decision when I looked at the work that needs to be done and the extraordinary platform that Time's Up is. I certainly love the WNBA. Everyone knows that I am the biggest fan of the organization and the players and the game at large. But this is a higher calling, a chance to help not only women in sports, but also women across the globe. How would you describe your vision for the future, especially for Time's Up? I really want to coalesce the voices that started this organization, with the voices of the men and women who are joining us every day. I can tell you what success looks like. It's that no woman or man has ever... I can tell you what success looks like. It's that no woman or man has to say Me Too ever again. We will have institutionalized new laws, new protocols, new practices, and new behaviors that enable men and women to reach their full potential, not only in the workplace, but in every place. What would you like people to know about Time's Up? There are women standing in support of one another, and they are offering a very stiff arm to maltreatment in any form. So whether it's discrimination or harassment in the workplace or poor treatment of women anytime, anywhere in the world, Time's Up will have a voice against that bad intention. What was your upbringing like? I was raised in Atlanta. My mother worked in my father's office. He was an internist. Ours was a loving home that was incredibly supportive. My paternal grandfather was a Baptist minister for 50 plus years at Wheat Street Baptist Church. He led boycotts against discrimination by what was then Rich's department store. They were brought by the parent company of Macy's in later years. My grandfather was incredibly powerful during that time and civically engaged beyond the four walls of his church. His work instilled in me the values of fairness and the belief of his equal access and opportunity for all. What have been some of your most difficult challenges? The challenges probably started in high school. I helped to integrate an independent school, Westminster, in 1969. Being a person of color at that time was difficult all across the country, not just in my home in the city of Atlanta, but going through the adversity of integrating a school where you are called racial slurs every day really set the tenor and the tone for who I am. I am a bit of an overachiever, for sure, always trying to demonstrate that I deserve to be in a particular place or that I can achieve what others are achieving and surpass what they are achieving. What would you say is your superpower? I think helping people reach their full potential as a leader, one of the things you must learn to do before you lead is to follow. That means listening to the team you have around you. I don't really believe in hierarchy, which means delegating responsibility. Diarist Anne Frank famously said that, in spite of everything, she believed people were good. Do you agree or disagree? I agree. Often when people show their dark side, it's because they are in fear of something being taken away from them. We have to move beyond fear into the light. Fear is a dark place. We have to work from a mindset of abundance rather than a belief in scarcity. The next article, also from Essence, is titled How I Survived 3 Heart Attacks. In 2014, Tara Robinson of Fort Worth, Texas, was working as a middle school teacher when she suffered 2 minor heart attacks, then a massive one. Miraculously, the wife and mother of 2 lived to tell her story. Here, the 45-year-old shares how her family, faith, and lifestyle changes have helped to keep her heart strong. I was only 40 years old when I had 3 heart attacks, 3 days in a row. The first occurred while I was sleeping. It was April, a month before my 41st birthday. I remember sitting straight up in my bed, aware that something was seriously wrong, but I had no clue what it was. My left arm was numb, my neck hurt, my chest felt as if I'd taken a large pill that was stuck and wouldn't pass. No matter what I did, I was hot, clammy, and nauseous. I woke up my husband, fiancé at the time, and told him we had to go to the emergency room right away. By the time I arrived in the ER, I felt fine. You're too young to be having a heart attack, the attending physician commented. You're right, I responded. I'm trying to live my best life. At the time, I thought heart attacks only happened to white men and obese people, not a slender and vibrant black woman like me. Since my EKG, CAT scan, MRI, and blood test results came back normal, the ER doctor instructed me to follow with my primary care physician and sent me home at 4 a.m. 5 hours later, I had a second heart attack while I was teaching. This time, my symptoms were even more intense. I fell to my knees. My students were in a panic, and my assistant called 911. Back in the ER, my cardiac enzyme blood test was slightly elevated, so they kept me overnight for more testing. Once again, the results came back normal. Following that second trip to the hospital, I came home and resumed business as usual. I was cleaning my shower when I had the third heart attack. I crawled to my bedroom where my husband found me curled up on the floor. I told him I just wanted to lie down in bed and take a nap. You don't get to die on me today, he said. I arrived at the ER for the third time in 3 days with white foam coming from my mouth. I remember hearing, you're having a massive heart attack. I still couldn't believe it. I felt sick, but there was no crushing pain in my chest. As I was rushed into the emergency heart surgery, I was praying. It turned out that I had a 99% blockage in my main artery, a condition known as the widowmaker. When I woke up in intensive care later that day, the cardiologist told me, God has you in the palm of his hands. If I had taken my symptoms more seriously, I wouldn't have left the ER the first time, even though the doctor there discharged me 4 months before my series of heart attacks. I had gone for my annual checkup. During the appointment, I told my doctor that my left arm had been going numb on and off, and I had a painful crook in my neck, as if I had slept wrong. I think as black women, we tend to self-diagnose and make excuses for why things are going wrong in our bodies. My doctor concluded that since my blood work was normal and I didn't have hypertension or high cholesterol, it was probably stress. I accepted and put the symptoms out of my mind. What my doctor and I failed to consider was my family health history. My mother has high blood pressure and high cholesterol. I later discovered that 7 of my father's 8 brothers died from massive heart attacks, and so did their father. Before I had my heart attacks, I didn't understand that I had inherited genetic risk factors for the disease. As I recovered from my ordeal, I learned to manage my stress with meditation and yoga, and to detach from anything that robs me of my peace. I also exercise faithfully, cardio for 30 minutes, 3 days a week, and weight training for 1 hour, 2 days a week. Although I've always been physically fit, my diet also needed improvement. I loved fried foods and down-home desserts, but now I eat mainly fish and veggies. I've replaced fried chicken with baked chicken and traded beef for ground turkey. Throughout my healing process, my family has been my biggest support. I don't know where I'd be without them. My husband has always been a health nut, and now he cooks healthy meals for our family. My daughter has changed her eating habits too, and we've also started a family garden. These days, I speak at black churches and to sorority groups to dispel the myths many of us have about heart disease. Now I know the truth. Heart disease doesn't care whether you're fat or skinny, young or old, black or white, and I tell survivors like me to keep surviving. The next article is from Ebony. Coach Brian Flores is unsung hero of Patriots Super Bowl win. A day after spearheading a New England Patriots defense that held a Los Angeles Rams offense to a single field goal in Super Bowl, former defensive coordinator Brian Flores was officially named head coach of the Miami Dolphins. Flores' defense was integral in the Patriots' win. When you remember that the Rams, who scored only 3 points Sunday night, averaged 32.9 PPG in the regular season and 28.0 PPG in the postseason, they were second in the NFL in scoring. His success is even more sensational and praiseworthy. They scored 3 points, owner Jonathan A. Kraft said. They were second in scoring in the league, and they scored 3 points. However, other than Flores' highly anticipated promotion, not much recognition has been given to him in the media. This isn't surprising, nor is it some major injustice. Fans generally tend to care more about the players who execute the plays than the coaches who create them. But in a league where there are only four minority head coaches, Flores' story matters just as much as any player who's benefited from his strong game plan. Flores, a son of Honduran immigrants, who, according to ESPN's Ian O'Connor, lived with his four brothers 20 stories above, a community that could be perilous to navigate, was a defensive end and running back prodigy as an eighth grader. He was also a grade A student, and so when it came to picking colleges, he chose Boston College over a wide circle of major college programs, offering him a full ride because of its academic standing and proximity to home, O'Connor writes. In 2003, Flores was the Eagles' second leader tackler and would have scored an NFL contract if he hadn't torn his quadricep muscle his senior year. Despite this setback, Flores still found his way onto an NFL team, just not as a player. According to the undefeated Jason Reed, the former Boston College linebacker initially worked in New England scouting department, joining the organization after graduation in 2004. He then spent 11 years grinding as a Patriots assistant, learning from arguably the greatest coach in the history of professional sports, Bill Belichick. After Matt Patricia, the Patriots' former defensive player, left to become the Detroit Lions head coach, Flores took on his role, succeeding with flying colors. Now, this Bronzeville native has an opportunity to establish his own legacy with a brand new team. And that's all that time we have for that article. We have run out of time for today's episode of Ebony. We hope you have enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Avery Lewis, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org.